Remember the day you bought your first automobile? I can remember driving mine home, for I had my friend Mel Blanc with me. Mel and I still work together, and I still have the Maxwell. Isn't that amazing? Mel Blanc, the man of 1,000 voice characterizations. And speaking of characters, there's still another graduate of radio around today. And I do mean around every Army, Navy, and Air Force base in the world. The old ski nose himself, Bob Hope.
Thank you, fellas. No whistling. We'll have the place loaded with dogs. Thank you very much. Thank you. Well, here we are at the Pasadena Army Service Forces Regional Hospital. That's an ambulatory phrase, meaning don't step out the back door, Joe. It's a 100-foot drop to the sewer. Yes, sir, I've done a couple of shows in hospitals recently. I feel so much safer when there's a doctor close by. And this is a wonderful spot for a hospital. When a battle fatigue case comes in, and they can't calm them down and make them sleepy the usual way, they just give them a pass to go into Pasadena. Pasadena, that's a town where the curfew goes on at 12 noon. No, but I want to tell you, it's a great place to live. Pasadena is a very quiet town. In fact, every time a soldier takes a walk, the Chamber of Commerce appoints a man to follow behind him and oil his GI shoes. Somebody ought to oil my tongue for a while. And Pasadena is really a ritzy town. They're so fussy here, the mayor meets the Greyhound buses at the city limits with a can of flea powder. So ritzy, I put a nickel in the Pasadena jukebox to play one meatball, and it came out one caviar croquette. I saw one beautiful rich debutante here this afternoon, though. Boy, she was really loaded. She had money, too. But these soldiers aren't impressed with the local register here in Pasadena. When they go out with a girl, they don't care about who's who. They want to know it's what. This hospital used to be a hotel called the Vista del Arroyo. That's a Spanish term meaning why, Sergeant, the young lady was just admiring my cast, and we got so engrossed we must have strolled into Hollywood without knowing yet.
Back around 1948, television was beginning to gain in stature. The stars were still the property of radio, but it was obvious a change was in the wind. Fred Allen was already making plans. And he revealed those plans on his show one evening when a gatecrasher joined him for a sequence that requires all of your imagination.
Benny was born ignorant, and he's been losing ground ever since. Benny was doing a monologue with a pig on the stage. The pig was there to eat up the stuff the audience threw at Benny. Why, some weeks he used two pigs. Benny is the only guy in New York who has to bounce his nickels for the manager before they let him in the automat. Who would be low enough to sneak into a tour to save 60 cents?
There's the guy. Hey, you!
Who, me?
Jack, how can you be so cheap?
All right, go ahead. Be like the other radio comedian. Tell some cheap joke. I won't even eat in the sun. My shadow might ask me for a bite.
Your shadow has teeth? Jack, now look. Jack, don't get excited. Look, if you're cheap, you're cheap.
That's the way I look at it.
Well, Jack, if there ever was a time that you and I should not argue, this is the time.
What do you mean, this is the time?
Well, haven't you heard? A lot of the radio programs that have been on for many years have been canceled. By the way, you finished tonight, didn't you?
Yes, sir. Tonight was my last show of the season.
Did your sponsor mention anything about your program coming back in October?
Well, no, Fred, but we have a mutual understanding. You see, we always sort of take it for granted.
Oh.
The season ends, the sponsor shakes hands with me, and then we... Yikes!
Jack, what's wrong?
Tonight he didn't shake hands.
Cheer up, Jack. When you retire, you can tune in on my new show.
New show?
People don't want entertainment today. A radio show has to give away things. Nylons, iceboxes, automobiles.
You mean to stay on the air, you have to give things away?
Yes.
I'll die first.
Well, not me. I'm auditioning my new program tonight.
And you're, Fred, you're giving things away?
Tons of stuff.
Well, Fred, as long as I'm here in the studio...
Oh, no, I'm sorry, Jack. Professional... Professional people cannot participate. It's a rule.
But don't you ever find people on these programs changing their names to get something for nothing?
Well, occasionally we do catch a phony, but we're on the air. What can we do?
Now, Mr. Allen, we're ready for your audition. I'll run along, Fred. So long.
So long, Jack.
Giving away things for nothing.
Well, all right, let's try out my new show.
Here he is, the man who will change one of you nobodies into king for a day, the old kingmaker himself, Fred Allen.
Thank you. Thank you. And here is our first eager contestant. Your name, sir?
Myron Proudfoot.
Myron Proudfoot? You look like a chap I know.
I'm not interested in your friend. Start giving things away, brother.
What is your occupation, Mr. Proudfoot?
I'm a chaplain in a bakery.
What does a chaplain do in a bakery?
I put wings on angel cake.
How long have you been in the cake business, Mr. Proudfoot?
Long enough to know a crumb when I see one. When I see one.
Now, don't get sarcastic, Mr. Proudleg.
The name is Proudfoot, and make with the question.
All right. Who is the sixth president of the United States?
John Quincy Adams.
John Quincy Adams is correct, and Mr. Myron Proudfoot is king for a day. Well, Your Majesty, how do you feel?
Never mind how I feel. What do I get?
Immediately after this program, Your Majesty will be guest of honor at a banquet at Hamburger Heaven. Tomorrow morning, through the courtesy of the Sanitation Department, you will be guest conductor on the 11-5 garbage run through the Bronx. At night, in your ermine robe, you will be whisked by bicycle to Orange, New Jersey, where you will be the judge in a chicken cleaning contest. I'm king for a day! And that's not all.
There's more?
Yes, we are going to start right now to make you look like a king. Your suit is a little baggy, King. Boys, take His Majesty's coat off.
Wait.
On our stage, we have a Hoffman pressing machine.
Now, wait a minute.
Wait a minute. An expert operating the Hoffman pressing machine will press your trousers.
Now, wait a minute.
King.
You better keep my shirt on.
You're a little late, folks. Tune in
now,
again.
Come on, Alan. Give me my pants.
Quiet, King.
Alan, this is a place. Stop. Where are my pants?
Benny, for 15 years I've been waiting to catch you like
Alan,
this.
Alan, you haven't seen the end of me.
It won't be long now.
I want my pants.
Do your youngsters ever ask you, what did you do before television was invented? Now, sometimes it's hard to answer that question in a way that they'll understand. Of course, we read. And we played out in the fresh air a lot more, or at least that's what we tell the kids. But maybe there's another answer. Ask them to come in now and listen to these wonderful bits of imaginative trivia.
Have you tried Wheaties? They're whole wheat with all of the bran.
They're gone strong, the all-American boys.
Wave the flag for Hudson High, boys. Show them
be champion, known throughout the land.
Wheaties, breakfast of champions, bring you the thrilling adventures of Jack Armstrong, the All-American Boy. Jack Armstrong is climbing up the dangerous mountain trail to the cave of the glacier. High above him, the towering peaks of the Andes press their eternal snows against the South American sky. And far below lies the valley with its hotel and winter sports. Jack and his friends are seeking Whisper, whom the enemy agent Lazaro has captured and brought to the cave of the glacier. Right now, Uncle Jim leads the way with Senor Quesada, the Secret Service man whom they rescued from the enemy agents, and Jack and Billy and Betty follow not far behind.
Did I hear one of the kids mention our old friend, the Lone Ranger? He was there and held us just as captivated as television's version.
The Lone Ranger!
I'll Silver!
A fiery horse with the speed of light, a cloud of dust, and a hearty Hi-Yo Silver! The Lone Ranger! With his faithful Indian companion Tonto, the daring and resourceful masked rider of the plains led the fight for law and order in the early western United States. Nowhere in the pages of history can one find a greater champion of justice. Return with us now to those thrilling days of yesteryear. From out of the past come the thundering hoofbeats of the great horse Silver. The Lone Ranger rides again.
Come on, Silver. Let go, big fella. I'm Silver. Hooray!
And there was a famous dog called King.
It's Yukon King, swiftest and strongest lead dog of the Northwest, breaking the trail for Sergeant Preston of the Northwest Mounted Police in his relentless pursuit of lawbreakers.
On King! On you, Husky!
Of course, at times, things did get melodramatic.
The following day found the inspector pacing the floor of his office at the Lake LaBarge headquarters. And Yukon King paced at his side. Both the man and the dog were worried.
The men should be back, King. They should have returned some time ago. King, I think I hear men singing. King.
Standing at the open door with Yukon King, the inspector saw a column of men riding four abreast emerging from the pine forest. The scarlet tunic seemed to blaze in the orange light of the setting sun. The men sat straight and proud in their saddles, and even the horses held their heads high, as if they, too, felt the glory of victory.
The maple leaves are emblem, dear. The maple leaves forever. God save our queen and heaven bless.
The inspector patted King's head and said,
"He's back, King."
"Hello, Inspector."
"Hello, King. Good work, boy."
"We're both glad to see you, Sergeant."
"Sir, the Indians have been subdued."
"Well done, Sergeant. The Yukon still belongs to the Crown. This case is closed."
And here's another old friend who entertained the younger set.
Hurry! And the fire!
Later, Pop Sweet Sparkies brings you Terry and the Pilot.
Do you remember I Love a Mystery, The Green Hornet? And, of course, there were many, many more.
Gentlemen of the jury,
You are the judges of evidence to be laid before you. Be just and fear not, for the true administration of justice is the foundation of good government.
Famous jury trials. Dramatizations of cases taken from actual court history. The names of persons and places have been altered to protect the identity of those concerned.
The United States versus Captain Jacob Thorne.
Early on the morning of March the 17th, 1919, the whaling ship Quantic sailed out of New Bedford, Massachusetts.
Baghdad. Martinique. Singapore. At all the places of the world where danger and intrigue walk hand in hand, there you will find Steve Mitchell on another dangerous assignment.
Mr. Keene, Tracer of Lost Persons, is based on the novel Mr. Keene.
Until a boardwalk bucker and a pair of dumbbells help pierce his armor.
Gangbusters, the only national program to bring you authentic police case histories. Gangbusters, presented in cooperation with police and federal law enforcement departments throughout the United States. Gangbusters, in America's crusade against crime.
This is the Man in Black, here to introduce this weekly half hour of Suspense.
As a contrast to terror, we also had adventure.
Oh, no. What evil lurks in the hearts of men? The Shadow knows.
The Shadow, Lamont Cranston, a man of wealth, a student of science, and a master of other people's minds, devotes his life to righting wrongs, protecting the innocent, and punishing the guilty. Cranston is known to the underworld as the Shadow. Never seen, only heard, his true identity is known only to his constant friend and aide, Margot Lane. Today's story, Death Stalks the Shadow.
Mallory's in the end cell, Mr. Murdoch. Just talk to him through the bars. You're the last visitor he'll see.
In cell? Right. Hello, Mally.
Huh?
It's me, kid. Peter Murdoch.
Murdoch. Gee, I thought you'd never get here.
Well, pull yourself together, Mally.
It's easy enough for you to talk. You ain't been sitting here waiting. Every day the chair getting closer.
Now, Mally.
You're testing the current. Listen. Hear that big dynamo turnover? Coming. They're testing it for me. For me.
Shut up.
Murdoch. You see the governor?
Yeah, I saw him, yes.
Well? Oh, say something!
There won't be any reprieve, kid. We're licked.
We're licked? That's funny, Murdoch. You ain't in here. You ain't gonna sit in that chair.
I didn't kill anybody, Mally.
Why, you dirty double-crossing rat. Who planned that killing? Who promised I'd never even do time for it? You did!
Well, I didn't figure on the Shadow, Mally.
Yeah, I know. The Shadow. He caught me. He didn't know I was only doing your dirty work for you. I should have told him.
Yeah, but you didn't.
I trusted you. Peter Murdoch, the great lawyer. You said you'd get me off.
I can't win all my cases.
You didn't even try. Throw me to the wolves. So the Shadow wouldn't learn the truth about you.
Well, it worked, didn't it?
Yeah. If I could get through these bars, I'd fix you, Murdoch. Anyhow, I can tell the truth about you. I'll sing so loud.
Sing your head off. My reputation is too good. Nobody will believe you.
The Shadow might believe me, Murdoch. Suppose I told the Shadow who turned Dan Mally from a decent kid into a killer.
Stop dreaming, Mally. This is the death house. Tonight you're walking right through that door down there and you're not coming back.
Why, you...
Oh, you'd better forget all about the Shadow. So long, Mally.
Come back here! Come back here!
So long, sucker.
Hey, Mally. Mally, any news for you?
Yeah. Bad news.
Gee, tough luck, kid.
Yeah, but I ain't through yet. Before they burn me, there's something I gotta do.
God! Hey, God!
Where's that tin cup?
God!
Pipe down, you guys! Pipe down!
What's the matter, Mally?
I want to talk to Commissioner Weston. I gotta see him right away.
What for?
He's gotta locate somebody for me. Somebody I want to talk to.
Well, don't stand there! Get me Commissioner Weston!
How did you happen to choose this cafe, Lamont?
Well, Margot, this is a place Commissioner Weston showed me, and I had hopes the gaiety might stop my thinking.
What's bothering you?
Today is the 12th, Margot. Young Dan Mally goes to the chair tonight, thanks to the Shadow.
But, Lamont, surely you don't regret the Shadow's having captured that murderer for the police?
No, not exactly. Mally fired the shot, all right, but I've never felt the case was completely solved. Let's forget that.
Oh, Lamont, look, when that waiter started for the kitchen, the door opened without his touching it.
Yes. Works by photoelectric ray.
Oh, what's that?
Look each side of the door, Margot. See those chromium fixtures sticking out of the floor? Lights hidden at the top of them?
Yes.
There's a beam of light between those two bulbs. When anyone approaches the door, his body breaks that ray. And whenever the ray is broken, the door opens without touching
it. Oh, how clever.
Yes, and convenient. But, Margot, I've sometimes thought it might even prove dangerous. To a certain friend of yours.
Whom do you mean?
The Shadow.
But I don't understand.
The Shadow can hide himself from the human eye, Margot. But he has a physical being. And the photoelectric beam could detect his presence.
Hush, Lamont. Here comes Commissioner Weston now.
Oh, I see. Well, good evening, Commissioner.
Oh, Preston, how are you? And you, Miss Lane?
Very well, Commissioner Weston.
Won't you join us?
Thanks, but I think not. I'm rather upset tonight.
Well, what's the matter, Commissioner?
Well... Miss Lane, have you ever heard of the Shadow?
The Shadow?
Oh, yes, Margot. You've heard the absurd stories about his great deeds, huh? All poppycock, of course.
I'd give anything to contact the Shadow right this minute.
But why?
A boy named Dan Mally goes to the electric chair tonight with vital information. The only person he'll talk to is the Shadow. It's because I don't know how to find the Shadow. I'm beaten. Well, I won't find him here. So if you'll forgive me, I'll run along. Good night.
Good night, Commissioner Weston.
Good night. Margot, my hunch about Danny's case must be right. Waiter.
Yes, sir.
Waiter, here's money for my bill. Never mind the change.
Thank you, sir.
Come, Margot, quick. I'm going to the death house now. As the Shadow.
Why doesn't he come? Why doesn't he come?
Were you waiting for me, Dan Mally?
Who's that? Who spoke?
The Shadow.
The Shadow?
There isn't much time, Mally. They're coming after you to take you to the chair. Speak quickly. What have you to say?
Plenty.
I can't save you, you know. You killed a man, Mally.
Yeah, I know. But it wasn't my idea, Shadow. Honest, it wasn't.
There was no evidence against anyone else.
Yeah, don't I know it. He's too clever for that.
Who is too clever?
The bird that got me into this. The smart fellow that sold a dumb kid on crime being a good business.
His name?
Peter Murdoch.
Do you know what you're saying, Dan? Murdoch's a famous criminal lawyer. His reputation...
His rep's a blind. Listen... Pete Murdoch's the biggest crook in this section. He's got a piece of everything. But right now he's planning a slum fire that'll kill thousands and net him a million from insurance companies.
You're telling the truth?
A man doesn't lie when he's only got a few minutes to live, Mr. Shadow. The job's going to be pulled late this week.
I'll investigate it then. If it's true, Peter Murdoch will pay for his crimes. But how can I get proof?
That's easy. Now listen. There's a friend of mine named Dopey Jake down by the wharves, number 5 South Street. Jake knows enough about Murdoch's latest plan to prove what I said.
I'll see him.
Yeah, listen. If you can get to the filing cabinet in Murdoch's house, there's records and things enough to finish him.
The Shadow promises justice, Dan Mally.
That's all I want.
They're coming, Dan.
Okay. I can take it. Thanks, Shadow. Thanks for coming.
Well, Dan, it's time.
Yeah. I know, Warden.
Unlock the door, Gus.
Right, Warden. Here goes.
Take his arm, Gus. Steady, kid.
I ain't scared. I ain't. Not as scared as Murdoch will be. Wait till the Shadow gets him.
All right, men. Forward.
Shadow. Man, don't be Jake. They'll fix him.
Goodbye, Mally. Come on, kid. Keep your chin up. Come on, Mally.
Dan, the other prisoners are saying goodbye.
So long, boys.
We'll be seeing you, Mally.
Murdoch. Jake. The Shadow.
There was Radio Adventure. So vivid and so good that recently 160 radio stations around the nation have rerun The Shadow using the original dramatizations for a whole new generation of Americans. I'll be back with more samples of radio's value as entertainment. Though comedy and drama provided the warm family memories of those golden years, the dramatic punctuation that underscored our lives and helped to change the course of destiny came from the news bureaus of radio. To take you through those years in a kaleidoscopic living history, I've asked a friend of mine whose voice has been a welcome visitor into millions of American homes to take over. Frank Knight has been the voice of the Longines Symphonette for over three decades. And before that, his special vantage point as chief announcer for the Mutual Broadcasting System's flagship station, WOR in New York City, makes him uniquely qualified to recall with us the momentous and some not so momentous moments in history. Frank, it's nice to be with you again.
Thank you, Jack. Listening to those great memories of radio brought back the names of so many of my friends that it's hard to know where to begin. Radio recognized its obligations very early. In 1920, station KDKA, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, broadcast presidential election returns for the very first time in history.
It is now apparent that the Republican ticket of Harding and Cooley is running well ahead of Cox and Roosevelt. At the present time, Harding has collected more than 16 million votes against some 9 million for the Democrats. We'll give you the state vote in just a moment. But first, we'd like to ask you to let us know if this broadcast is reaching you. Please drop us a card, address station KDKA, Westinghouse, East Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
The first transcontinental radio network broadcast was of a Rose Bowl game in January of 1927. In the same year, Lindbergh's triumphant return from France was broadcast coast to coast from Washington, D.C. The President of the United States, Calvin Coolidge, introduced Lindy to Congress.
As President of the United States, I bestow the Distinguished Flying Cross upon Colonel Charles A. Lindbergh.
I arrived in the bourgeois Paris. At every gathering, at every meeting I attended, were the same words. You have seen the affection of the people of France for the people of America demonstrated to you. Take back with you this message from France and Europe to the United States of America. Thank you.
About this time, the newspapers were beginning to recognize radio as competitor for the advertising dollar. Do you remember the joke making the rounds? What is the difference between newspapers and radio? Well, you can wrap a herring in a newspaper. Amos and Andy were using topical subjects then, and this was their comment on a certain election.
Who is the man that is running against each other this year election time? Explain that to me.
Herbert Hoover, Vesuvius Al Smith.
Herbert Hoover, Vesuvius Al Smith, huh?
Yeah.
Another thing I'm going to ask you. I don't know if I'm going to be a Democrat or a Republican, you know it.
How did your old man vote?
Oh, my papa, you mean?
Yeah, that's it.
Oh, papa used to always vote for the Democrats.
Well, then, if I was in your place, I would vote for the Republicans.
How come?
Because I never knowed your old man to do nothing right in his life.
And when the stock market broke in 1929, another of your favorite comedians, Eddie Cantor, took the opportunity to laugh at his own losses.
If the market takes another slump, I know thousands and thousands of married men who will have to leave their sweethearts and go back to their wives. Nowadays, when a man walks into a hotel and requests a room on the 19th floor, the clerk asks him for sleeping or jumping.
As the time for a new presidential election drew near, there were many very fundamental issues. The stock market crash and the resulting depression. The question of prohibition and the evils it had brought on the scene. One of the greatest orators of his time, legendary in his pursuit of sin, fanatic in his determination that prohibition should remain the law of the land, was ex-baseball player Billy Sunday.
The return of the saloon would mean the overthrow of civilization in our land. It was because I didn't want our boys to die drunkards that I fought and fight. I'm going to live long enough to see America so dry you'd have to prime a man before it can spit. And I'll fight the saloon from Hawaii to Hoboken. And I'll kick it as long as I've got a foot. And I'll fight it and punch it as long as I have a fist. I'll butt it as long as I have a head. I'll bite it as long as I have a tooth. And when I'm old and fistless and footless and toothless, I'll gum it till I go home to glory and it goes home to perdition.
The first United States president to take full advantage of the growing power of radio was Franklin D. Roosevelt. Starting with his own first inaugural address, FDR took to radio no less than 20 times in the first 9 months of office.
I, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, do solemnly swear that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. So help me God. This is a day of national consecration. And I am certain that on this day, my fellow Americans expect that on my induction into the presidency, I will address them with a candor and a decision which the present situation of our people impels. This is preeminently the time to speak the whole truth frankly and boldly. Taxes have risen. Our ability to pay has fallen. Government of all kinds is faced by serious curtailment of income. The means of exchange are frozen in the currents of trade. The withered leaves of industrial enterprise lie on every side. Farmers find no market for their produce, and the savings of many years in thousands of families are gone. More important, a host of unemployed citizens face the grim problem of existence, and an equally great number toil with little return. Only a foolish optimist can deny the dark realities of the moment. So first of all, let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
As FDR turned his strength towards solving our domestic problems, the rumble of trouble began in Europe. New voices from afar became familiar to listeners in the United States as radio began to shrink the world. Against the background of disturbance in Europe, a thoughtful radio voice warned the United States to watch the East. In 1935, Edwin C. Hill, a crack NBC commentator, had this to say.
Still another of those useless, troublemaking naval armament reduction conferences gets underway in London with prospects already darker than your cellar at midnight. Good old Uncle Sam, always hopeful, tells Great Britain and Japan that he would like to welcome a 20% naval cut. John Bull shuts up like the clam of commerce. With Hitler building up a navy for Germany and Mussolini on the warpath, doesn't suit him at all. But Japan speaks out with an emphatic no. As an American, I admire the idealism and good faith of our government, but sometimes I do wish that our beloved Uncle Sam would stay at home and mind his own business. Someday, we may get our fingers burned. Mind our own business, speak softly, carry a big stick, and keep an eye on Japan as far as this side of the Pacific is concerned. Clyde Pangborn, famous flying man, testifies before a congressional committee that, in his opinion, America is threatened by only one enemy, and that enemy is Japan. He testifies that Japan has perfected man-operated aerial torpedoes in which the plane and the bomb are one, an instrument deadlier than any known weapon, certain to bring death to the operator. Yet thousands of Japanese, says Pangborn, have already volunteered for the honor of dying as pilots of these infernal weapons of infernal modern warfare.
1935 also saw Case Closed written on the official records of the famed Lindbergh kidnapping case, 3 years after Lindy's infant son was kidnapped and killed.
The National Broadcasting Company presents a special bulletin from the Press Radio News, Trenton, New Jersey. Bruno Richard Hauptmann was electrocuted at 8:47 tonight for the murder of the Lindbergh baby. This bulletin is from the Press Radio Bureau. This is the National Broadcasting Company.
Nothing to fear, but fear itself, became the classic rallying cry of that recovery era. Radio carried that message of hope to homes throughout the nation. It has become a classic. Radio broadcasts of lasting impact became more frequent during the turbulent 30s as the world underwent change after change. One classic broadcast with an impact of intensely personal nature occurred when the dream of the dirigible crashed with the Hindenburg in Lakehurst, New Jersey. The description by Herb Morrison and his engineer Jimmy Nelson belongs in this collection because never again has a disaster been broadcast right from the spot from the first second when fate took a hand in what was to have been a routine news broadcast.
We both flew down from Chicago yesterday afternoon aboard one of the giant new 21-passenger flagships of American Airlines. It took us only 3 hours, 55 minutes to fly nonstop from Chicago to New York. When we landed at Newark, we found another flagship of American Airlines waiting to take us to Lakehurst with our equipment when we were ready to go. And incidentally, American Airlines is the only airline in the United States which makes connections with the Hindenburg. The Hindenburg left Frankfurt, Germany, Tuesday evening, at 7:30 their time. And for better than 2.5 days, they've been speeding through the skies over miles and miles of water here to America. Now they're coming in to make a landing of the Zeppelin. I'm going to step out here and cover it from the outside. So as I move out, we'll just stand by a second. Well, here it comes, ladies and gentlemen. We're out now outside of the hangar, and what a great sight it is. A thrilling one. It's a marvelous sight. It's coming down out of the sky, pointed directly towards us and toward the mooring mast. The mighty diesel motors just roared, their propellers sliding into the air and throwing it back into a gale-like whirlpool. No wonder this great floating palace can travel through the air at such a speed with these powerful motors behind it. Now, a field that we thought active when we first arrived has turned into a moving mass of cooperative action. The landing crews have rushed to the posts and spots, and orders are being passed along, and last-minute preparations are being completed for the moment we have waited for so long. The ship is riding majestically toward us like some great feather, riding as though it was mighty proud of the place it's playing in the world's aviation. The ship is no doubt bustling with activities we can see. Orders are shouted to the crew. The passengers probably lining the windows, looking down at the field ahead of them, getting their glimpse of the mooring mast. It's practically standing still now. They've dropped ropes out of the nose of the ship, and it's been taken a hold of down on the field by a number of men. It's starting to rain again. The rain had slacked up a little bit. The back motors of the ship are just holding it just enough to keep it from... It bursts into flames. Get it started. It's crashing. It's crashing terrible. Oh, my. Get out of the way, please. It's burning, bursting into flames, and it's falling on the mooring mast, and all the folks agree that this is terrible. This is the one of the worst catastrophes in the world. Oh, it's flames. 20, 400 or 500 feet into the sky. It's a terrific crash, ladies and gentlemen. The smoke and the flames now. Andy Framer's crashing to the ground, not quite to the mooring mast. All the humanity and all the furniture screaming around here. I don't do it. I can't even talk to people whose friends are out there. I can't talk, ladies and gentlemen. Honest, it's just laying there a massive smoking wreckage. And everybody can't hardly breathe and talk and screaming. Lady, I'm sorry. Honestly, I could hardly breathe. I'm going to step inside while I cannot see it. Charlie, that's terrible. Listen, folks, I'm going to have to stop for a minute because I've lost the voice. This is the worst thing I've ever witnessed.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm back again. I've sort of recovered from the terrific explosion and the terrific crash that occurred just as it was being pulled down to the mooring mast. The terrible amount of hydrogen gas in it just caused the tail surface broke into flame first. Then there was a terrific explosion, and that followed by the burning of the nose and the crashing nose into the ground, and everybody tearing back at breakneck speed to get out from underneath it because it was over the people at the time it burst into flame. Now, whether it fell on the people who were witnessing it, we do not know. But as it exploded, they rushed back. And now it's smoking, a terrific black smoke floating up into the sky. The flames are still leaping maybe 30, 40 feet from the ground, the entire 811 feet length of it. They're frantically calling for ambulances and things. The wires are being humming with activity. And I've lost my breath several times during this exciting moment here. Will you pardon me just a moment? I'm not going to stop talking. I'm just going to swallow several times until I can keep on. I should imagine that the nose is not more than 500 feet or maybe 700 feet from the mooring mast. They have dropped two ropes, and whether or not some spark or something set it on fire, we don't know, or whether something pulled loose on the inside of the ship causing a spark and causing it to explode in the tail surface. But everything crashed to the ground and there's not a possible chance of anybody being saved. I wish I could stop in just a moment and see if I can get my breath again. And Charlie, if you'll fade it out just a minute, I'll come back with more description, ladies and gentlemen. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm back again. I raced down to the burning ship, and just as I walked up to the ship, over climbed over the picket line, I met a man coming out, dazed, he couldn't find his way. I grabbed a hold of him. It's Philip Mangone, A-N-G-O-N-E, of New York. Philip Mangone, he's burned terribly in the hands, and he's burned terribly in the face, his eyebrows, and all his hair is burned off, but he's walking and talking plainly and distinctly, and he told me he jumped. He jumped with other passengers. Now, there's a Mr. Spay. It sounds like Spay. We're not sure of it. And he also got out. Now, it is my sincere hope the majority of the passengers jumped when it came close to the ground, according to what Mr. Mangone told me. He says, thank God he jumped, and we say thank God for him also.
...1936 was an important year in the affairs of the United States. Radio took us outside of our boundaries, and a slow awareness was beginning to overtake Americans that what happened in Europe could act upon our own destiny. This was the year that civil war broke out in Spain. Soon the battle would be drawn as Hitler, Mussolini, and Stalin used Spain as the testing ground for weapons of war. It was in the same year that a British monarch died, George V, and perhaps he symbolized the passing of an era, just as the death of Winston Churchill closed the leadership book on World War II.
On the coffin lies the crown, the orb, the scepter, and the insignia of the Order of the Garter. As it goes by, the King's Guard blur the colors and present arms. Behind walks King Edward VIII.
In 1937, Edward VIII abdicated.
At long last, I am able to say a few words of my own. I have never wanted to withhold anything. But until now, it has not been constitutionally possible for me to speak. But you must believe me when I tell you that I have found it impossible to carry the heavy burden of responsibility and to discharge my duties as king as I would wish to do, without the help and support of the woman I love. And now we all have a new king. I wish him and you, his people, happiness and prosperity with all my heart. God bless you all. God save the king.
To complete the circle of succession, George VI was crowned with the pomp and ceremony that only the English can mount. Here are the final moments as reported live.
Prince Albert Frederick Arthur George is now become our only lawful and rightful liege lord, George the Sixth. By the grace of God, of Great Britain, Ireland, and the British dominions beyond the sea, King.
Radio news reporting was growing in stature. The march towards World War II began to accelerate. By 1937, the cauldron was simmering as England's Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain went to Munich.
This is Max Gordon calling from Munich, Germany. It is now 2:08 a.m. local time. Exactly 17 minutes ago, Premier Chamberlain of England, Premier Daladay of France, walked of the assembly room at the first palace here. Benito Mussolini, the Duchy of Italy, followed them shortly afterwards to catch his special train for Italy. The Big Four Conference of Munich has come to a formal close.
After my visits to Germany, I realized vividly how Herr Hitler feels that he must champion other Germans. He told me privately, and last night he repeated publicly, that after the Sudeten German question is settled, that is the end of Germany's territorial claims in Europe.
As the United States became aware of the fallacy of peace in our time, radio news reporting polished its techniques, gained in wisdom, and began to take its place as the recorder of living history. On-the-spot news coverage came of age, and from the archives of the National Broadcasting Company comes an example of radio news reporting at its very best.
Ladies and gentlemen,
The National Broadcasting Company again this morning brings you a special broadcast from the Navy Yard at Portsmouth, New Hampshire. 11 miles out in the Atlantic Ocean, near White Island Light, the United States Navy has concentrated ships and equipment in an attempt to rescue 59 officers and men trapped in the submarine Squalus. The submarine rescue ship Falcon reached the scene about 2 hours ago, and those 2 hours have been occupied in dropping its moorings, anchoring the ship above the spot where the Squalus went down. Naval officers here at Portsmouth say they are optimistic concerning the results of rescue operations. Apparently, the first attempt to reach the sunken submarine and its crew will be made in the Navy's rescue chamber, an 18-foot metal cylinder in which the divers are protected by compressed air. Down at the 240-foot level where the Squalus rests, the chamber will be attached to the submarine hatch, and crew members may enter it 8 or 10 at a time for the ascent to the surface. On the Falcon are 22 of the Navy's expert divers. And earlier this morning, 13 other divers put out from the Navy Yard aboard a fast Coast Guard patrol ship. It was just 23 and a half hours ago that the Squalus submerged on what was to have been a routine dive below. An hour later, when the submarine's commander, Lieutenant Oliver Naquin, failed to report his return to the surface, the sister ship Sculpin put out from Portsmouth. Near White Island Light, the Sculpin sighted a distress smoke signal shot from the Squalus. And a few minutes later, the crew found a signal boy carrying a telephone cable to the submerged ship. The cable snapped, but not until Lieutenant McQueen had reported the after chambers filled with water. That was the last communication until last night, when signals notified the Sculpin that conditions on the Squalus were good but cold. And now at the microphone beside me is Bill Eddy, NBC television engineer and a former lieutenant in the Navy's submarine service. Bill, I think, first of all, that most everybody is asking the question, what will be the procedure at the scene of the rescue operation?
Well, Chick, the Falcon is here, as you know, and she is now engaged in laying down her four anchors preparatory to mooring directly over the stricken submarine.
I see.
The next step will be to drop grapnels into the deck for guidelines, and down these guidelines, the first diver will probably descend. He will make a preliminary observation, report to the surface, and get his orders. Then a diving stage will be lowered, bringing one or more additional divers to assist in anchoring the salvage chamber to the torpedo room hatch.
The question all of us are anxious, of course, to know, how long can a modern submarine remain submerged safely?
Well, under normal conditions, at least a week. But we have no knowledge of what the conditions are out there on the bottom.
Well, could you possibly tell our listeners what might be going on down in that sunken vessel? From your experience with submarines, what would you say the men are doing?
Well, first of all, it is pitch black because they appear to be unable to use the forward battery. Lieutenant Naquin has no doubt ordered all hands to lie down in their bunks and cover up so they won't use too much oxygen.
We've heard that the ship is in about 240 feet of water. Is that an excessive depth, or in other words, is it going to be a difficult dive?
Well, 240 feet means 105 pounds per square inch. Yes, it's a dangerous dive, but a possible one.
Well, all right, thank you very much, Bill Eddy. This special events broadcast has come to you from press headquarters in the Navy Yard at Portsmouth, New Hampshire, where rescue operations are in progress to lift the submarine Squalus from the floor of the Atlantic. Keep tuned to your NBC station for latest developments.
The acid test of this newborn technique gained in stature in the months that followed by bringing history, live at the moment it was happening, into the living rooms of America.